I'm starting another session on dreams, Jung and you, and this one is entitled, What is Therapy All About? Welcome, all the new people, and good to see all the friends and familiar faces as well. What I'd like to talk about today is what happens in the process of psychotherapy, and why should we go see a psychotherapist, and what is the difference between psychotherapy and psychoanalysis? So, and then afterwards we'll have questions. If any of you have been in the lapidary and polished a stone, you know what you do, how you do it. You get the raw stone is polished into these reflecting surfaces. And sometimes I liken psychotherapy to the polishing of a stone. The psyche has many facets and it has to be polished and made to shine. Now, that's just an image. Usually what happens is that somebody comes in very conflicted, is unable to decide. Indecision is often one of the major symptoms, and needs to talk about a problem or a conflict that they cannot resolve by themselves. Now, my husband, as I was preparing this, said, well, why don't you just go talk to a friend? Well, a friend can often be a very good therapist. Therapist means person who helps you become whole or healed. A really good friend who's a good listener can help you a great deal. And I would say that if you have a good friend, the chances are you will not need a therapist. But there are many people who do not have this good friend, or if they have friends, they're just not good listeners or not mature enough. And there are areas that you cannot share even with your closest friends sometimes. Similarly, you may have a pastor who has training in therapy or in counseling who would be the next person to see if you have a problem or a conflict. Well, the pastor is also someone who stands on a very high pedestal, and you might feel uneasy, depending on how close, what good a relationship you have with them. Nevertheless, there are certain times where you feel you cannot see the pastor, or the pastor does not have counseling training and then sends you to a psychiatrist. But it is not something that you should feel ashamed of. It's no different than if you should break your arm and have to go see a man who will put it in a cast, or if you have an ulcer and you have to have surgery. You don't postpone those things. But if you feel conflicted, depressed, totally at sea, unable to solve your problems, you usually put off seeing a therapist until things really begin to fall apart. And I would urge people to do a little preventative psychotherapy, going for counseling before things fall apart. And we all go through crises. There are several kinds. There's supportive. If you come in and you're in a crisis, and let's say you have just lost your spouse, the grieving process may take 6 months. You need support. Again, this pastor may not have the time, that's another factor, to give you the weekly support that you would need. And there is a kind of supportive psychotherapy where you don't try to do anything except help the person go through the process of grieving. Any loss requires the process of grieving. Processing your emotions is absolutely necessary when you've had some kind of trauma, if you've had an accident or whatever. There is therapy in which the person comes in and wants to grow and understand his dreams. And this is what I do mostly. I deal mostly with young creative people who are, most of them are artists, and they're not sure where they're going. They're not productive, their creativity is somewhat stifled, or very much so. They don't know where to put their energy, and I talk to them and analyze their dreams. The dreams are mirrors that tell me what's going on in the unconscious. In the earlier sessions, I said the reason for remembering dreams is that they're the only way, the only mirror that can tell us what is happening in the unconscious. And that it is the equivalent of an x-ray for the doctor, you see. You cannot look into the psyche without the x-ray, without the dream. Now, the difference between psychotherapy and analysis is that analysis goes much deeper and is usually recommended when you want to train to become an analyst or a therapist yourself. I went through 3 and 2, that's a total of 5 years of analysis. In that case, you begin to get to lower, deeper levels of the unconscious, and you have to face all the areas in yourself that you don't want to face, and I'll talk about that later. Facing of the shadow, at least recognizing your shadow, is essential. The shadow being the dark side of yourself, that which is unacceptable, that which gets in the way of functioning, that which is trips you up, that which is just the dark side of yourself. Psychoanalysis was started by Freud and carried on by Jung and his followers, both kinds of followers, and there are many theories. Many practitioners who are neo-Freudians or Gestalt or primal scream, there are many theories, and I would say it's like denominations. We're all trying to do the same thing. Help the person heal his psychic split, his psychic conflict. I personally have opted for Jung, and I will say why. Carl Jung was a Swiss psychiatrist, and he worked with Freud until they parted ways because he felt the unconscious was wider and more creative and more forward-looking than Freud postulated, who saw it only as filled with sexual libido and the death instinct. I could spend the whole time on the difference between Freud and Jung. I just want to say here that I've opted for Jung because that is my particular field. The approach that we use is a face-to-face situation, and it's a dialogue. The therapist listens. There's a book called Listening with a Third Ear. Now imagine having a third ear somewhere. You listen for the undertone, you listen for the feeling, you listen for the nuances, and if you have the gift, and there is a gift of intuition, then you intuit what the person is really saying, no matter what the words are up here, you see. Also take into account body language and a lot of clues that we are trained to look for. And we listen very carefully to the first statement when the person comes in. And often it's a throwaway line. And in my practice, I find this quite true, that the person comes in and as they walk in the door, they're saying something which at the end of the hour is very, very important. Then the whole hour is spent on all kinds of other things. That first statement often gives a clue to what's really going on. I'm just wiped out. Then we sit down and say, well, how was your week? Oh, just fine, but I had this and that, you know. Anyhow, the first statement and the first dream that the client brings in is very important because it's all like the prelude, the statement of the problem. The next thing that happens usually is that the client explains where he's coming from, as we say, what his problem is. And then it takes a long time to work through the various aspects of what he needs to deal with. And a certain transference occurs, where transference is the projection of all the love and warmth onto the therapist. He's made almost a god. And the first sign of the first sign of transference usually is a sign that something's beginning to happen. And I have a client who has long hair, and one day she came and had her hair braided. Well, I said, oh, that was a sign of transference, for example, very visible. Other signs are that they bring you presents, they write you letters. I've gone through this myself. In fact, I had to go see where my analyst lived, you see. It was very important. But you're sort of, we call it cathected. You just worship the analyst. He can do no wrong. Every word he or she says is pearls of wisdom. And we're only mortal. I mean, we're trained, but we're still not. And then when you come to the next phase and point out to them their shadow or their weak side, their dark side, a negative transference occurs. Suddenly they're late, they miss appointments, they feel very negative towards you, and will resist your interpretations. Now that's the other side of things happening, you see? See the dynamics? Nobody likes to be faced with the ugly things that are in your psyche. And when you interpret a dream, they say, no, but I think this is so-and-so. And I have one who's very argumentative, and we go through this. And with each person, you use a slightly different way of reacting because, and I'll talk about that later too, they pull out of you a certain reaction. And as I explained to one of some people here, I think, I have a client who walks in the door, never stops talking till she walks out. She can hardly listen. And what I'll need to do with her would be to have her slow down and listen, you see. I have another one who comes in very quietly and sits in there, pools of silence, you see. So it's very different for each person. Also, I always make a practice of having an interview to get acquainted, to see if we can work together. There are certain people that we might not be able to work together, and then I have other people I could refer her to, her or him. Some people should work with a woman, some others should work with a man. It really would depend on what your difficulties are. A Jungian therapist or analyst does not go into the family history other than to understand the family, where the person grew up, how many siblings in the family, the overview of the family history. But we don't go back and go through the Oedipal crisis or the oral and anal and libidinal phases. We just don't go through this systematically because we start at a point where the person is now and look forward, saying that whatever has happened, we will only deal with it as it is relevant to the conflict. And thus we save a lot of time and money. It doesn't mean we're not going back. It simply means that we go back only as these things come up in dreams or in specific conflict situations. The money situation is also very relevant. An analyst, because of his training, he usually has an MD and training in psychiatry, charges between $50 and $60 an hour these days. And they often, if they're Freudians, want to see you 4 and 5 times a week. So can imagine how much that adds up to. Well, you have to have insurance. The Freudian analysis requires a couch and the analyst sits behind you and all you do is free associate. Again, you bring in your dreams, but you free associate. You just let your unconscious go. And you get very deep into your unconscious, to the point where living out in the world becomes difficult. You spend 4-5 hours a week in the analysis and you're told to spend a lot of time analyzing yourself at home. And our feeling is that this is almost too much emphasis on what's going on inside, that you can never, that you're not testing it enough against reality. The Jungian analysis, even an analysis, is not more than twice a week in a face-to-face situation, and every insight or every insight that is gleaned during the hour is to be tested against the reality out there. For example, if you find that the person is too dependent, many people who are struggling with chemical dependency are struggling with this problem of being too dependent on one person or a drug, but let's take it, too dependent on one person. You help them understand, recognize the dependency, the nature of the dependency, and to literally wean them bit by bit, and for them to go out and test this in the real situation, so that when they are tempted to lean too heavily on the other person, we urge them to make their own decision, to stand on their own 2 feet. Well, maybe they don't do it the first time, but you see, you need a little space to go out and test what you have learned in the therapeutic situation. Coming to terms with your shadow, coming to terms with your dependency, is then the major task that we have in the psychotherapy. at what point is your therapy over? That's a very tough question. You get into a good working relationship, and you get over the negative transference, where I said the person resists your interpretations, and now again, you come to a point where you're working together, and now it is a really in tandem working. They bring in dreams, you analyze them more or less, and there's input from both. We find out the context, we dip into mythology, and we analyze the dream as deeply and as thoroughly as the person cares to and as the dream commands. And as the time goes on, usually something like 6 months, growth occurs and is usually evident in dreams, and the person seems to be able to solve the problem that he came in with. This is a good case. Now, it doesn't always happen, but it usually does. And one very good example, I saw an artist, a young lady who, she didn't know if she wanted to paint or sculpt, and she didn't know if she wanted to write poetry. I think those were the three options. Well, as time went on, she never brought in a poem, but she always brought in some very nice drawings. And then she wasn't sure how she would get away from home and where she should live. Well, as she got stronger and more independent, she found a studio, and the studio cost her the exact amount that it would cost her to come and see me. She says, I want the studio and I want to paint. Well, that solved it just so neatly, you see. And it was, money-wise, it was an exact balance, you see. So she put the money to the studio, and I saw her then 6 months later, and she was perking along and had a boyfriend and so forth. So things were going well. I usually ask people to come back for either every month or for 6 months so that they can wean themselves gradually and come back and say what's been happening to them. Because it is very scary when you've been seeing somebody and you've gotten very dependent on them to suddenly be cut off completely and be on your own. And when you go to a doctor, you know, and you've had surgery or something, they usually ask you to come back for a 6 month checkup. So why shouldn't we do this for psychotherapy? And they always laugh when I say, well, come back for your 6 month checkup. Do you have any questions so far? Yeah?
This is relevant. Does he not go into astrology and that sort of thing?
Oh, you ask if Jung goes into astrology. Yes, Jung was interested in just about everything that had to do with psychic phenomenon, astrology, alchemy. Tomorrow I will dip into alchemy a little bit. Mythology, fairy tales. One of the best ways you can raise your children is to read them fairy tales. Turn off the TV, read them fairy tales. Fairy tales contain the archetypes and the wisdom of the ages, and they can deal with the kind of violence that's depicted in fairy tales. As for astrology, yes, he was quite interested, and I think young people today are almost all interested in astrology.
Would you say there's any relevance to astrology?
Well, I personally think there is, but I give it a certain weight. I'm not, 100%.
How can children deal with the violence in fairy tales and not that they see on the TV or hear any kinds of stories?
Well, anyone else wonder? Well, let's see. Because TV is a medium that deals with brutality rather than violence, and they're not concerned with the values or educating the kids, but simply entertaining them. And I think that's one aspect. The other one is that the fairy tales and myths have been handed down through generations and generations and contain those kernels of wisdom, which I don't think you could say for TV, except for rare programs.
Do nightmares indicate?
Well, simply the disturbing dream. We can talk about that later, perhaps. Okay.
If one doesn't dream much.
All right. Well, my first session I was talking, I maybe should review this here too. We all dream every night three or four times when our rapid eye movement occurs. There's a period of deep, deep sleep that's motionless, then you come up to lighter sleep. There's rapid eye movement and a dream occurs. If then you're woken up, you would remember a dream. But by morning, you've had three or four of these episodes, and at best you will remember the last dream that you had. But only if you really want to remember it. You have to let it rise. You have to spend 5 minutes or so with your eyes closed and letting the dream come back to you. And the motivation for remembering is what's important, and the having paper and pencil handy and your glasses handy so that you can do it right away. You can train yourself to do that. If you don't remember them, even after you sort of try to, then it simply means that at this moment the unconscious isn't speaking very loudly. It's not important to you. It's not always important to remember them. But when you need to have a message, you will have one. You will get it. There are those dreams, and we call those numinous dreams. They're filled with the archetypes. They're filled with light. They're filled with sort of bizarre images. And they kind of shake you. And they're not necessarily nightmares at all. They are the kind that you say, gee, I woke up. And then you tell everybody. You don't have to write it down. That's when the unconscious wants to speak to you. And recurring themes occur, and they take different forms, and that's the message that you want to pay attention to as you go along. Why is it important? I think the Bible points to the importance of dreams. Almost the Old Testament and the New is filled with dreams that are very important. I would like to spend a whole session on dreams in the Bible. Maybe we can do that. And in therapy, it's essential. So, and in my own experience, I have found that dreams are definitely guides and contain a lot of wisdom that our conscious mind just doesn't have. Anyone else? Yeah.
How does a person go about choosing the therapist that would be best for them?
Yes, that's a very, very good question and a difficult problem. Usually, you go to someone, and often you start with your pastor or with a friend who's in the professions, and they know of someone. And then if they do it like I do, and that is sort of a standard procedure, you see the person, and if they don't feel that they could work with you, they will recommend you to someone else. And part of our training is to know what kind of person is best suited for what kind of problem, in quotes. And I think you have to be outspoken too and say, I think I'd like to work with you, or I don't think I'd like to work with you. I'll give you an example. I had a lady come in who was recommended by a friend, and she sat on the edge of her chair. She was from Germany. I was raised in Austria. I don't like Germans very well. She pounded the table and she talked like this, and she talked and she talked and she talked and she talked. And at the end of the hour, I said, well, I don't think I can see you. I recommend X, Y, and Z. You see, I mean, I myself could not have taken this onslaught, but there was someone else who could. Did you have a question?
Do you differentiate between psychotherapy and counseling that you might receive through social worker, psychiatric social worker, marriage counselor? Do you group that all the same thing, but depends on the type of problem?
Well, maybe we could make a hierarchy. Say counseling, marriage counseling, would be 3 to 5 times sessions where you deal with a specific problem by a social worker or a marriage counselor. And I don't think you would deal with dreams in that. I think the next level would be psychotherapy, either Jungian or Freudian, in which a psychologist, trained psychologist, who himself has been analyzed, will look at your dreams as well as your conscious life. And that would be like 6 months to 9 months, or a year. And then there would be analysis, psychoanalysis, which would be the longest and the most thorough, which would be up to 2 or 3 years, and that would be by a psychiatrist. Are you all familiar with the training of a psychiatrist? A psychiatrist has to go through medical school and get an MD, and then intern as a psychiatrist in a hospital, and so that they also can prescribe medicines and drugs. They are always associated, in the clinic we always have a supervising psychiatrist in case the person needs drugs. But they go by the medical model, and we have a lot of quarrels. We psychologists or therapists have a lot of quarrels with psychiatrists, because when somebody comes in diagnosed as a schizophrenic, okay, we'll prescribe the drug and tranquilize them, and that's it. And then the therapy is dealing with very superficial things because the person is so lulled into a kind of, zombie-like existence, that you're not getting very deep, but you're keeping them quiet and happy and manageable. And the medical model also means that we're looking at the diagnosis, and we have in our book this and this and this and this, and we say, well, this is what one does with a schizophrenic, that's what you do with a psychopath, and that's what you do with a paranoid, and that's what you do with a manic depressive. Those things are valid. However, the reason I like the Jungian approach is that we try to leave the labels behind as much as possible and talk to the center of the person, and to evoke in him the sense of his uniqueness and uniqueness, period. To speak to the person as though we didn't know anything. Jung said when he walked into this counseling room, he left behind him all his intellectual apparatus of learning and spoke heart to heart, and I think that's why he had so much success, in part. That doesn't mean he didn't use his training, but he relied on his intuition, which is a gift. And I myself have found that that works very, very well. There are different approaches. Again, when you have a face-to-face situation, you look the person in the eye, that's very different from lying on the couch and sitting behind the person and never seeing them. So there are real controversies in the field. But the aim in all psychotherapy and analysis is to help the patient help themselves. And our greatest temptation is when they say, well, what shall I do, to sit forward like a friend, to say, well, I think you should do this and so. No, a therapist can't do that. They have to highlight the size of the problem and say, and what do you think you can do? You have to always put it back to them and help them help themselves. And I always liken it to process of weaning, basically. When they become terribly dependent, what shall I do, doctor? What shall I do, Mrs. White? How shall I do this? You see, you must not fall into this trap of saying, I think you should do this and so. Rather, you must say, if then, point out, if you do this, this will be the consequence. If you do that, that will be the consequence. And to help them help themselves, and to give them the confidence that the psyche is self-healing given enough time and support. So what we provide basically is a support system. We all need it, especially people who don't have friends, you see. You who are surrounded by family and friends cannot imagine the loneliness of some people who are just isolated.
Based on your experience, and I don't know how much you have, but how much can you assume or state about a person in, say, an hour session? If I came to you, how much can you tell me just because you have a certain amount of experience?
Oh, well, that's, you know, you're saying when you first come in and what you say in the first hour, which would be getting acquainted hour.
Put me in a little slot and say...
No, I don't put people in a slot. That's the thing. That's the difference. I worked in a clinic for many years, and there we always had a little intake sheet. We had an intake worker who would do this processing, and then we were assigned different patients. And we had this sheet as to what the diagnosis was. Well, yes, of course we had to go by it, but I would try to talk to the person face to face and sort of intuit and feel what I felt their problem was, and to deal directly with the situation. There is an interesting thing. The first hour, the person always says much more and hides an awful lot, yet gives very clear clues as to what the real problem is. And it would be too long to go into that right now, but when you are desperate for help, as most people are who come to see a psychiatrist, you're usually also willing to put the cards on the table. That's one reason why we have to charge. I personally feel it's terrible that we have to charge money, yet unless you pay, unless you make some kind of sacrifice and put in some energy, money, you will not really work or really put your cards on the table. In the clinic, we had a few patients who were free clients, and they were almost sort of sitting back. The ones who had to pay the more money really worked harder. This is not true always, but I remember that as one example. I shouldn't bring that really in as a variable, but it does happen. Any other questions? Yeah.
Before you were talking about how do you know what therapy is or anything, the real essential elements in a termination with a client or a transferring to another therapist?
I didn't hear the first part of your sentence.
When you were talking about when therapy is over,
yeah.
Could you tell me some of the basic ideas you think are really essential in terminating with a client or transferring a client to another therapist?
I think it's important to be aware when the client is having a negative transference and is canceling because it's a negative transference, and when he's ready to stand on his own. It's not always easy to decide that. I usually want it to come from the client or from the patient so that he says, I think I'm ready. Sometimes there's a natural break, like when I went to Holden, I said, well, I'm going to be gone now for a month. So there was a natural break, and one got married, and that kind of solved her problems. And well, maybe not. Actually, it did. And so sometimes a natural break, and then some were very eager and pinned me down. I've got five of them already all pinned down. When will you be back, But then others felt that maybe we could let it go for 6 months and see how things go, you see. So it's up to them to come forward, and for me to make a tentative statement. Usually I say, well, don't you think that, et cetera, things are going. Marvin?
My question is, I'd like to have your comments to a man who goes in for therapy, and he said, I told the doctor everything that he wanted to hear. In other words, I just pulled the wool over his eyes.
Well, all right.
What would be your comment to that kind of, I knew he didn't, but I mean, how should we react when these people come back to us with this kind of a comment?
Well, what was he doing when he said that? How would you, what was the...
Well, he'd been in for a long period of counseling with a psychiatrist, and he thought it was an absolute waste of time. Okay. And he didn't think he was getting anywhere at all. And so his comment, I guess one day I just happened to ask, how are you getting along? And he says, oh, I just told him everything he wanted to hear. He says, he doesn't know nothing at all.
Uh-huh.
He hasn't helped me a bit.
All right. Well, what is that? That is a real resistance, is it not? He does not want to cooperate. And many people who are psychopaths or psychopathic tend to have that attitude. Nobody can help me. Nobody knows anything. A waste of time. I'm sort of in a special place, and I'm not going to tell them anything. I'm just going to play a pretend game. In fact, their whole life is a pretend game. Yeah. Psychopath.
In this case, that fellow was.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
His whole, it was really a pretense.
Yeah.
So could...
Well, just a minute, this.
How do people respond when you tell them that you can't work with them? I mean, say it's a paranoid person, and do they feel rejected by that, or do they feel like you're saying that you don't feel like you personally can deal with their...
Well, I usually say something like, I think there's someone who's better trained or who will help you better than I can. I don't put it in a rejecting way. I try not to put it in a rejecting way. My example here was just a little drama, you see. Yeah.
But even so, even if you couch in that kind of language, would some people still respond with, oh, she doesn't like me or something?
Well, maybe so. Well, they have to live with that. See, we can't like everybody. What I try to do is to leave itself open and have them call me back, so it's always on their decision, you see. I will say, now I think you might try calling these other people and seeing them, and then make your own decision. But if we really click, then we make another appointment right then and there with me, you see, so that when I send them suggest the alternatives for someone else, that's the veiled way of saying, I don't think I can deal. Another less honest way is just to say, I'm busy, I can't see you now. Call me in 6 months, you see. Mm-hmm. But I don't like to be dishonest. Yes? You were.
I was just wondering, you feel like our society today, is it becoming easier now to go to a psychoanalysis or a therapist and feel comfortable because, you know, like you see, you know, some friends that might go on you, they're really shy or even very hesitant about telling you this because people think you're crazy or off their ass. And also, do you think it's a good idea then, like in the medical field, where they tell us to come back for a yearly checkup? Do you think everyone should go to a psychotherapist every year for a yearly checkup?
Oh, I was saying that if you've been in a therapeutic situation, then you should come for a 6 months checkup. It's getting easier, yes. You're asking if it's easier in our society to go and see a psychotherapist or psychiatrist. It is getting much more acceptable, and depending on which subculture you're in. Now, if you live in Berkeley, as I did for a while, everybody was going to see their shrink. I mean, my shrink is better than your shrink. Then it was sort of a status symbol. There are subcultures where it's a status symbol to go see the analyst. In fact, the more you spend, the more time you spend with the analyst, the better. And then there are still groups where one does not go readily, and where, especially if one of your children, when our own children have problems, it's hard to admit that my own son had to go see a psychiatrist. That was very difficult, you know. I think that many of us think that we have failed, and that's not necessarily true. There are problems that they face nowadays that are very difficult. So I don't say anybody should go, but if they have problems that are, unmanageable, it's a good idea. Yeah.
Another question related to that issue about children involved. Have you ever worked with any disabled children at all that might have a lot of emotional problems, or you kind of stick with
I've normal worked stuff? With mentally retarded, but not disabled.
No. Mentally retarded? Yeah. What severity?
I don't know the term right now,
okay.
But
you do work with mentally retarded?
I did, yeah, for quite a while. And that was very helpful. But I think she had a hand up. Did you want to ask a question?
Oh, I was just going to make a comment about what this person was asking about. Clients feeling rejected when you say that you don't want, that you think someone else might be better trying to deal with their problem. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to make the comment that in someone's in a unique position to be able to negotiate like that, because a lot of people, especially a lot of really severely hurting people, don't have that. Go to people in public agencies where they don't have the option of saying, I can work with you or can't work with you. You get potluck when you don't.
Yeah.
That's a fairly unique position.
Right, it is, yes. And that's, of course, one of the advantages of going to a person in private practice. But in the clinic, we did have staff meetings, and I must say, and I want to tell everyone, that we weigh it very carefully, and we take into account the nature of the problem, of the person with the problem, and the expertise of the person. We had about 10 therapists, so that we would assign the client to the one who could best deal with them. And every week we had a staff meeting and we would evaluate it. And if you came back after, let's say, 5 sessions, and this has happened, and said, I'm just not getting anywhere with this person. I just think she should see you. She should see a woman. She was seeing a man. Or a younger person should see an older person, and so forth, whatever. We had all age groups and different people. So we assigned them to someone else, and one of the best experiences I had was when somebody came to me and said, I really can't get anywhere with her. We've reached this impasse. And then, because I came from a different point of view, and because of her nature, the nature of her problem, we were able to work in a different direction. So I think some clinics, many clinics, do very carefully weigh whom they assign to whom. Yes?
I wonder how you make the shadow palatable to some people. I also do family therapy, and I see a lot of Christian people who cannot accept that they have a shadow side, and it has to be Satan, and they direct it outside of themselves.
Yeah. Then how do you, may I ask first how you do it, or?
Well, I just state it as a fact. I say that that there's the shadow side of everything, and that I even think that God has a shadow side, and I think in the Psalm somewhere he says, I am the author of the destroyer, and that negativity isn't necessarily bad, that's a source of energy that our task is to transcend or to integrate. And I just say that it's a fact. But that bothers them.
Oh, yes. That's when the resistance starts, yeah. I usually do it through dreams. A shadow figure appears in a dream, and then somehow, I don't know why, but it's just a little more removed. And I say, you see, this appeared in your dream. Could this be an aspect? Could this be your shadow, your shadow side? And, I'll give you an example. There's this young man who came in and he had this Mutt and Jeff dream, or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type dream. And I said, well, draw these people for me. And what was surprising, he drew the man who was the shadow side as a very macho and kind of nice looking, and the good guy was kind of scroungy. Well, there, you know, it was just so obvious. It was really neat. I often have them draw aspects of their dream, and then sometimes it shows up.
So you lead it like a self-discovery that they discover.
Yeah, I try. That's both mostly how I like to work anyhow, is to lead them to discover for themselves. And now I have one more thing to say. There's another type of analysis or therapy where, in training, for example, if you want to be a therapist yourself, and again, counselors need a certain amount of professional training and psychological theory, but don't necessarily go through therapy themselves, do they? It's recommended, I'm not sure. If you're a therapist or an analyst, you have to, it's required. Well, in the Jungian Association, it's required that you have 2 years of analysis. Well, many of us need it anyhow, but we need it for training. So then you sit in the other chair, and having sat in the chair, in the other chair, and having been analyzed, you know what it feels like to feel this pain. You know what it feels like to be rejected and hurt or confronted with your shadow. And you recognize your resistance, and it's very exciting and necessary. And now I have one client who is herself a therapist. And she's doing it precisely so as to sit, to experience it. She's constantly doing it for others. And, of course, this is a pleasure because we talk the same language and we're really moving along. Yet there, too, we came to a point where she was quite perplexed. She said, gee, I never thought that this would happen or that I would see this, you know, when she was confronted with her own dark side. But we know with our intellect and what we experience in the therapeutic relationship are just very different. And one of the defenses that people often have, and that ties in with what this man, that was a defense, I know what you really want me to say, or I know what it's all about, I know what that's troubling me, and I have all these intellectual theories, And this girl who's talking, a blue streak, is full of her defense, you see. She's just not letting the experience come to her. It will happen. But talking, intellectualizing can be a great defense. Yeah?
I was wondering if you could give us any helpful clues and hints, not to be a psychoanalysis end by any means, but maybe just actively listening and helping some friends and neighbors that might, or good friends that come to us, you know, and how can we be more actively without getting, you know.
All right. Well, I would caution you. Now, it would depend on what the problem is. As I said at the beginning, if you are a good friend and a good listener, and you're not going through terribly deep waters, I think listening and being a good friend is very important. But if somebody's really traumatized, is really hurting, I think we sometimes overestimate what we can do as friends. I would never try to be a therapist really to a friend because I'm too close. I'm too close. And then I don't see the forest for the trees. So when you're emotionally involved, it's a little dangerous sometimes. But it depends on the nature of the problem. For the everyday problems, I think you can listen creatively. I hope that helps. I don't know. But I would caution against being, and I would certainly caution those of us who are trained to be therapists to our spouses. That's a no-no.
Well, we all do that, don't we? Is that how we get all the trouble we get into?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I didn't smile there in the corner. Yeah?
I was just wondering, what types of skills do you try to develop, help a person develop when they're having problems making decisions?
Well, I think you can answer that, can't you? Well, let's try this way. I would start with very simple decisions that don't involve his life goals. You see, if you say, now, do you want to go into music or the seminary? Well, that's precisely what he came in and couldn't decide. But it evolves. I couldn't tell you specifically, but starting from the smaller, building up from the less emotionally threatening to the most emotionally threatening. Another thing, when you asked me that, how do I know in the beginning? I may intuit in the beginning that your problem is of a certain nature, and I might be tempted to tell you then and there what it is that you have to do, but you couldn't hear it or absorb it, because you have to experience it in the process of therapy. So we often say things, and I experienced this when my analyst told me things and I wasn't ready to hear. There's a readiness, and that's another fascinating thing. That's that path of individuation. Each person is ready at a certain time to receive and to use the advice or the interpretation that the therapist gives, you see? So that we try to work gently and slowly and to listen for the readiness of the client before we say something that might be disturbing or upsetting. That's why it takes so long sometimes.
Yeah. I was just wondering what you think of a therapist who, on your first session, you open yourself as completely as you can, and the second session you're given the wham, this is it, and this is your shadow. Mm. And just scare the life out of you. And this kind of experience. And you don't really agree with that.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, I think it should be done very slowly and certainly not ever throw the whole book at you the first time. But again, it depends so much on what the problem is. Had you experienced this or was
yes,
this?
I experienced it one time. Uh-huh. I went to another therapist after that.
Well,
and I was much
right. Yeah. But then you know the difference
between. But it
between
took a year.
Really? Yeah. It takes time. Really takes time. That's also what we're hesitant to invest in. You know, if you break an arm, you know, you say, all right, 6 weeks in a cast. We've sort of accepted that. You go to a psychotherapist, I think you have to expect 6 months to a year. I mean, you can't rush it. That's one of the laws. You cannot rush it. And to learn when to speak and when not to speak, you know, and when to interpret and not to interpret, that's something that has to be kind of experienced and learned. My tendency in the beginning when I was training was just to, you know, don't you think you know all these theories, and you say, well, of course, now this is what you should do, you know. It's such a temptation. Yeah.
Isn't there something to be said for being able to pick and choose of maybe two or three people if, for example, you don't get a positive response, and of course you're in that double bind of maybe not being able to discriminate or make a decision. Mm-hmm. So you say, I'm just resisting, I don't want to talk to this person, but I think I have to put quotes around what this person said up in front, that there are some flakes out there in therapy.
Oh, a lot.
And I, so I would just, you know, I would like to...
Well, even among doctors, if you go to a medical doctor with some problem, you should always get two opinions.
Sure.
And it is quite a good idea to go to several. It is not as clear cut as in the medical field, you know. You have specialists. If you have a skin problem, you go to a dermatologist, you see. And if you have a broken bone, you go to a man who can mend your bone. But among psychiatrists, we're sort of jack of all trades. We think we can deal with all problems. I think one thing I've learned is to be very cautious about the kind of person that I can work with, because there are other people trained specifically to deal with more disturbed people and in clinics. Okay?
Yeah. Do you usually just work with conversation type things, or do you get into any touch therapy, relaxation tapes, hypnotic tapes, any of that stuff?
How did you guess that I do use relaxation tape quite a bit, but I give them the tape to work with. I don't do it in the session. It takes too much time.
You record them separately and then...
I have a tape that I can give, that they can get, or that I... Well, it's only $2 usually. It's a tape that they can buy that's a relaxation tape that I highly recommend for most of them if they're very anxious. But if you get a very laid-back person, I think I need just the opposite. And I don't do touch or games things, no. It's mostly dream analysis, you see, that I do. And that takes a lot of time. I mean, even one big dream can take the whole hour, you see.
What is the relaxation tape? Is that talking or music?
It's mostly a kind of yoga, breathing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be very much in favor of that. I find it's helped me and it's helped most of my clients quite a bit. But again, I use my judgment as to who might need it. Mm-hmm. We have 5 more minutes before the bell rings for the...
If there is any dream, as you say,
yes.
How does a patient choose which dream he tells you about?
Just the other day I had this person who keeps a dream journal come and say, my goodness, I have 10 dreams, I don't know which dream to start with. Well, how did we solve that one? Well, I just said, pick one. I mean, pick the one that you think you want to start with, you know. I let them choose. Give them a lot of freedom. I have people who have kept dream journals and have a lot of dreams and are into dreams, and I have people, one or two, who still can't remember a dream and just come in with a little image or nothing. So we just deal with the situation, you know.